Hello and welcome to episode 56 of the History of Yugoslav Football Podcast, The Interregnum. Before we get into this episode, it's time to set out how the podcast is going to go over the period of history we're about to enter, because going over the breakup of Yugoslavia is undoubtedly going to go over some, shall we say, controversial ground, and into some difficult topics. Come the end of this episode, covering the 88-89 season, we're a year away from the Dinamo Zvezda riot at Maksimir, perhaps one of the most mythologized events in the entirety of footballing history. Then, a year later, there's Sfina Zvezda going and winning the European Cup, a feat directly followed by the last ever sort of full season of the Yugoslav First League. There's a lot to get through in this period, and it's simply not going to be feasible to do it as previous episodes have been, covering approximately a season at a time, and not at the same time have episodes that are of a length that could be described as somewhat formidable. So, after this episode, we go on an immediate break from Yugoslavia to do one thing I've mentioned in an episode a little while ago, a history of Albanian football up to the end of communism, which will, of course, cover a large amount of Albanian and Kosovan history. Because we're going to be dealing with Kosovo a lot in the run-up to the millennium and beyond, it's right to bring in the Balkan neighbour with whom relations have been the most fractious and give them a proper mention in our next episode. Once that's complete, then we get into the full breakup arc, which we'll have to cover 4 years of the international team, including Italia 90 and Euro 92, three full seasons of domestic and European football, a riot, a war, some independences, lots of politics, and something to bring everyone up to date on just who the hell will actually be playing football after countries become independent. Between where we are now in 1988 up to the signing of the Dayton Peace Accord in 1995, we'll probably need around 15 episodes-ish to do everything properly, giving appropriate background, going through the war, and then setting the scenes for each part of Yugoslavia that becomes independent, including a swift run through the Republic Leagues, as there are a lot of clubs that will be prominent straight away after independence, who we simply haven't met yet because they've never made any headway in the full Yugoslav setup. In brief, there's a lot coming up. And when the country splits from one Yugoslavia into lots of little nations, it's going to inevitably get quite complex as we go from running one nation and one timeline to seven nations and seven timelines that will be running one after the other. But first, we have to talk about the 1988-89 season, the first season in which we see Scheiber's penalties in practice. Now, if you skip the past few episodes, then just to give you a quick rundown on what Scheiber's penalties are, any time a league game was drawn, the game ended in a penalty shootout to determine who got the point for the draw. The problem with that was, there were 67 draws in this season. Now, that may not sound that many, but it is 22% of all games ending in penalties. For one, that's a lot of penalties. It's so many penalties, in fact, that the renowned stats service, the RSSSF, contains week-by-week tables and results for every Yugoslav season, except the ones where Scheiber's penalties are around. I even contacted the Yugoslavia stat collectors for the site who don't have the information. So where, in previous episodes, we could do a week-by-week breakdown of title races and whatnot, Scheiber's penalties were so problematic that even the statisticians weep at the prospect of having to cover them. Plenty of other people would also have reason to weep about them, and no side would have more reason than Rijeka, who took part in seven draws with seven shootouts, and won precisely none of them, earning them 0 points. A season prior, their draw record would have had them on 37 points in total for the season. In this season, their profligacy from the spot meant they only had 28, enough only to finish 10th. In fact, one could argue that the title itself would be decided by penalties, with the gap between the top two being smaller than the gap of shootouts won and lost for each side. The beneficiary of this would be a man who, over the next couple of years, would have a very handy ability to be in the right place at the right time. Ljupko Petrović. Vojvodina would be the third of what currently stands at 32 managerial spells at various clubs for Petrovic. His first spell was an initially successful one at Osijek, but one that slowly declined until Petrovic left for Spartak, while also having a hand in the youth setup of the national team, specifically the 1987 World Youth Cup winners. Vojvodina took a chance on Petrovic, having been promoted back to the First League in 87 and finishing in mid-table in that season. But over that season, they actually put together a pretty handy team, and Petrovic would immediately add two key pieces to the mix. The first was a local boy by the name of Slavisa Jokanovic. The second was a player who Dinamo Zagreb had flirted with but never pulled the trigger on, by the name of Sinisa Mihailovic. Combined with what was already at the club, not least a returning to Yugoslavia in Milos Sestic, they were a formidable outfit for Petrovic to take over. Mihailovic's early days were pretty wild on their own, with his career almost never taking off at all, after being identified by Dinamo and them always finding reasons just not to sign him, most ridiculously, once refusing to sign him until he cut his hair. Mihailovic joined Vojvodina with a big curly bouffant to rival anyone's lockdown hair, to take his place in the midfield of a side with one of the most gloriously 1980s kits you could ever wish to see, a strip every bit the garish equal of some of the club's mid-90s efforts. Well worth checking out Vojvodina's strip history. With two other important additions in Vujacic and Taniga in defence, Petrovic had looked into a side that were ready to challenge from the off. In week two, they did for Hajduk at home and would go on to defeat Partizan, beat Dinamo 4-1, Zvezda 3-1, and beat Velez at home to sweep away with the title, thanks in part to winning all but one of their six penalty shootouts, while Zvezda won only two of their seven to finish 3 points behind. Zvezda had roared home domestically, thrashing sides, but paid for their issues from the spot early in the season to fall short. The surprise of the season would be promoted to Drag, finishing fourth and getting into the UEFA Cup courtesy of 9 penalty wins, the most of any side in the league, ahead of Dinamo, who had won 3 more games than them, and Partizan as well. Between Zvezda in second and Rad in fourth would sit Hajduk, who were still serving their European ban, which allowed Dinamo to access Europe, while Partizan in sixth would reach the Cup Winners' Cup after thrashing Velez 6-1 in the final. The bottom of the league would be tainted by match-fixing. The final day of the previous season had seen a relegation fight between Šalić and Pristina, which had ended in extraordinary fashion. Pristina had gone 2-0 up, but would have been relegated anyway due to Sucheska getting a result elsewhere, something which became clear late on in Pristina's game. The result was that Šalić scored 3 times in second half injury time, in varying fashions of Pristina quite obviously not putting much effort in, culminating in a comical winner where the defence just plain old gave up. The fix was uncovered because it was very, very obvious. Šalić were deducted 6 points for the 88-89 season, and they would end up 6 points detached at the bottom behind Napredak, who were also relegated. Šalić could at least console themselves with winning one of the wilder shootouts of the season, beating Partizan 11-10 on penalties at the JNA. The second tier, which had reformed itself into one national league as opposed to two regional ones, would see Olimpia, Ljubljana and Borac Banja Luka returning to the top flight. If penalties cost Zvezda in the league, then they did so again in the European Cup. Not in the first round, where they thrashed Dundalk 8-0 on aggregate, but in the second, as Zvezda took part in one of the most controversial ties of the late 1980s. In that round, they would face AC Milan. The Milan side of that era was, let's be honest, quite good. Aldini, Hullit, Rijkaard, Baresi, Van Basten, and they would go on to win the tournament after hammering Steaua Bucharest in the final. Against Zvezda, however, things were much tighter. At the San Siro in the first leg, that showed itself in a 1-1 draw. Zvezda would take the lead after Milan failed to react to a quick free kick, and the ball was fed into Pixi Stojkovic, who proceeded to dribble past two defenders before sliding the ball past the keeper at the near post. While the TV replays were still going on, Milan equalised, a loose pass setting Verdis free to score. But with the away goal, Zvezda had the advantage going into the second leg at the Maracanã. And that advantage would that they had would be amplified come the second half in Belgrade. Savicevic would drill a ball into the top corner from the edge of the box on 50 minutes before Verdis was then sent off. But the fog was coming in, and as the game entered the last half hour, visibility was becoming an issue. With 25 minutes left, the game had to be abandoned, and UEFA decided the game would have to be replayed, and replayed the following afternoon. The lineups would be the same as the night before, aside from two key differences. Verdis's suspension for being sent off was to be taken immediately, with the same happening for Carlo Ancelotti, who had received his second booking of the tournament in the abandoned game. As such, Milan started the game with two completely fresh players. Milan took the lead through Van Basten, and while Pixie would equalise soon after, Zvezda's advantage from the first leg, their hard-earned advantage from the abandoned game less than 24 hours, was gone up in smoke. Zvezda would hang on for penalties, and Milan would progress 4-2 after misses from Mikaela and Savicevic. Branko Stankovic, back at the club for what would be a short spell, would become the first of two managers who would see their Zvezda team denied controversially in successive seasons. Stankovic would depart soon after a large falling out with Pixie, to be replaced with a Zvezda legend on par with Stankovic and Stojkovic, Dragoslav Sekularac. In the Cup Winners' Cup, Borac would put up a fight against Metalist Kharkiv, winning the home leg 2-0, before the Soviet strength would show in the second leg, with Borac falling 4-2 on aggregate. The UEFA Cup would at least see the three participants win their first round ties. Velez struggled to a 1-0 win over Apoel Nicosia in Mostar before winning in Cyprus 5-2. Partizan would beat Slavia Sofia 5-0 both home and away to progress with ultimate ease. Dinamo, meanwhile, lost 1-0 to Besiktas in Turkey, but a Radmilo Mihailovic double at Maximir saw them through. Only Velez would progress beyond the following round. Dinamo were dumped out by Jürgen Klinsmann's Stuttgart. Partizan took a 4-2 lead to Italy, but would go out on away goals to Roma, while Velez squeaked past Belenenses 4-3 on penalties. Velez's adventures would end in the third round, as they fell pretty timidly to Heart of Midlothian. This season represented a turning point in Yugoslav football. Much like the 1960s, when the title win of Vojvodina bridged a gap between the dominance of Partizan's babies and the dominance of Miljanic and Jajic, the title win of 88-89 bridges the gap between a period of Partizan's dominance, albeit a period that never quite fulfilled its potential because of all the assorted goings-on with Scheiber's round, and a period where Zvezda will dominate. The remaining seasons of the Yugoslav era will see a different rivalry set the scene, not one just between Belgrade clubs, but between Sveta Zvezda and Dinamo Zagreb. A rivalry that would eventually turn into Croatia versus Serbia, and that rivalry would eventually tear an entire nation apart. But next time on the History of Yugoslav Football Podcast, we take a hop to the southeast to find out just what's been going on in Albania this past few decades before we begin the final countdown for Yugoslavia as we know it. Thank you very much for listening. I am going to check that this is actually recorded, because the first time I recorded this about an hour or so ago, I realized my microphone wasn't actually plugged in, which, given I'd recorded two episodes at that time, is really quite frustrating. So please do come back. I will catch you next time for another extremely professionally made episode, of course, of the History of Yugoslav Football Podcast.